Welcome to the Richie Flow Nutrition Podcast. My name is Cameron Borg. On this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with Andrew Marino. Andrew is a retired biophysicist and lawyer specializing in the biological effects of electromagnetic energy. Working closely with Dr. Robert Becker for much of his career, Marino has played a pivotal role in understanding the impact of non-native electromagnetic fields via stress response pathways in animals and humans. His work has raised fundamental questions about the safety of wireless communications technologies, power lines, and the ever-growing number of gadgets we are surrounded by. He is the author of several books, including Going Somewhere, which documents the harsh realities of a life in science. His story is poignant and highlights how science can be manipulated and watered down at the whims of those in power with little regard for human safety. His forthcoming book, Philip Handler, Toxic Pope of Science, details the long-lasting effect some critical figures have had in shaping what we perceive today as science. Speaking with Andrew was such an honor. His work has shaped the way I view science immensely, and I'm so grateful for his unending dedication to the field. Before we start, please consider subscribing to my Substack, where I share further insights into these podcast topics and provide a depth of information not possible here. This is the best way to support myself and the podcast. With all this being said, I hope you enjoy the episode. Andrew, it's been a long time since I first contacted you, and I can't tell you how much of an honor it is to be able to sit down and chat with you for a little bit about your career and your ideas. And I'm just so grateful that you've given me the opportunity to sit down with you, because you've been a massive influence to me, and you're very, very well regarded in our small community of people. So thank you so much for giving me some time. So I think most people know you from your brilliant books. I think predominantly Going Somewhere, which is so fantastically written. It's almost like a novel. And, you know, you got into this career with Dr. Becker, who is, you know, somewhat well known. And, you know, I guess a lot of people wonder about how electromagnetic fields interact with biological systems. It's a very complex sort of topic, but you and Dr. Becker were at the forefront of this for quite some time. So just as sort of a brief background, how is it that these man-made fields impact biology?
You mean how does the body know that they're there and hence in a position to respond?
Exactly right. How do we pick up on that?
In lower life forms, there are structures, identified structures, that that receive natural electromagnetic signals in the environment. Birds and fish can navigate and locate their prey. In humans, the only universally accepted detecting system is the eye. There's a protein, rhodopsin, in the eye that changes configuration, which sends a signal to the brain, and hence you see. All other forms of electromagnetic energy, including anthropogenic electromagnetic energy, man-made electromagnetic energy, are contentious and disputed because of their potential economic consequences. The industry tends to deny and denigrate the possibility of detection. And for years and years and years, we fought the fight to establish the existence of detection. We're just beginning now to deal with the question of the mechanisms of detection, because now that it's clear, at least to me, that the effects are real and not impossible, like was asserted, they must have mechanisms because they're real. The mechanisms that I think are responsible, and I've presented many papers to support the hypothesis, is that it's a form of sensory detection, just like the eye. There are nerve endings that respond to the external electromagnetic energy and send a signal to the brain that it's there. And then the brain, in its evolutionary wisdom, does what it thinks is best. That's the whole process in a nutshell.
And I guess it's quite easy to forget the fact that this sort of spectrum that we're talking about is an extension of the visible wavelengths that we're familiar with how we see. And I wanted to ask you about the fact that we get lots of different wavelengths or frequencies from the environment and man-made electromagnetic fields as well. Are there any salient differences between the types, where, like microwaves versus radio waves? Are there differences in the biological effects of those different wavelengths or frequencies?
Well, there is so little research that has been done to answer questions like that, that I have to say there's no answer to the question. Keep in mind that when Dr. Becker started this field, was an offshoot of his idea of using electromagnetic energy to heal, to grow bone. When he started, there was no belief at all among anybody of any importance that electromagnetic energy in the low frequency range, high voltage power lines, for example, or electricity in household electricity, or a higher frequency, the kind that's sent out as radio or TV signals or cell phone signals, there's no concept that they had any biological consequences at all. And for 30 years, I spent my time doing research to prove that there were effects. So since there were effects, there had to be processes by which the body detected it. And we've only reached that point by the 1990s. Only by the 1990s was absolutely clear to me, and I think generally accepted, that the effects existed. Then I began trying to understand what biophysical process occurred to allow them to be detected. And it came to the conclusion that it was sensory detection. And I narrowed it down to certain specific molecular processes that occur in the membranes of free nerve endings in cells that allow this detection to take place. And I established in subsequent publications that this was consistent with the laws of physics. The scientists who worked for the industry denied there were effects because physics prohibited it. That's how this whole process started, with Hermann Schwann in the 70s making that claim. So we had to go step by step. We had to establish, number one, that there were effects, and then we had to show that the effects were consistent with the laws of physics, and then we started to do the biology to show where the effects took place and developed hypotheses for what the responsible biophysical processes were. That whole process that I just described took me 60 years. It didn't happen overnight, and it had to go sequentially, as I just described.
It's such a fascinating thing to think about with the way that science works. And I wanted to know, because it's quite difficult to study the effects of electromagnetic fields on biological systems, what are some of the salient issues with research methodology and hypothesis generation in this field when it comes I guess the essence of the question is, what's sort of holding back good research in this area?
Well, that's a good way to put the question. And let me try to give you a good answer. you have to recognize science has three personalities. One personality is the intellectual activity that's involved. And I think that's what you conceive of as science. But science is also a tool for industry and government to meet their purposes. Now, if science seems to say X, where X is inconsistent with their priorities and objectives, then immediately science that they pay for springs up to respond to the science that they don't like. So there's this tool concept and divides scientists into two groups, which you might call the university scientists, who are doing what they can with few dollars they have available to do research and follow wherever it goes. And then you have scientists who work for industry and sometimes government who are doing anything they can to protect the interests of their employer, wherever that goes. If it's anti-science, in my perspective, fine as far as they're concerned. The third personality is that science is an adversarial process. It's like law. You have scientists who will say X, and you have other scientists, for whatever reason, will say non-X. So you use the word science, you're going to be clear about which personality you are employing that word. When I hear it from you, I assume that you mean the intellectual activity. And that's going to restrict my answers because I'm restricted by the other two aspects of its personality.
It's such an interesting way to put it, that science, you know, I think in our minds we see it as this perfect, you know, well-formed thing. And of course, it's not like that. And, you know, it's probably never been less what it should be than it is today. And, you know, from your point of view, because, you know, I think a lot of people, including myself, really look up to you as someone who is very trustworthy. You know, you've done the work, you've lived a life in science and encountered so many things. You know, do you have any tips about how to sort through the wheat and the chaff? You know, because there's so many things in the published literature that are just, you know, wrong or just pure speculation. But I guess to the average person, maybe even to some academics, it's hard to sort through that. So are there any ways in which we can, you know, really have a good grasp on how to think about speculative ideas?
Well, the last phrase you just spoke in this question, like the last phrase you spoke in the previous question, sums everything up and is perfectly put. You have to consider science to be, if you're a layman, nothing different than any other challenge in life. What's the best political party, Republican or the Democrat? Which country is better, United States or Australia? These are all questions that have to be approached to the extent, number one, that you're serious about answering the question, and number two, a more perfect phrasing of the question. If you don't, if it's just a cavalier issue to somebody, the issue you raised, then I'd say they have no chance of understanding. If they just listen to what he says and what he says, and they can't make up their mind, they're done. Forget it. They'll never know. If it's a matter of importance to them, they've got to do their due diligence. They've got to investigate. And the first question they've got to ask is, what does this guy say? What does that guy say? Are they different? The second question is, who's paying that guy and who's paying this guy? And then you go from there. Like any other thing in life, if you care about it, you investigate it intelligently. Otherwise, you go on to something maybe that's more fun.
Do you see it as an issue that our modern environments are so bathed in anthropogenic radiation, the stuff that we're making, Wi-Fi, like you said, high voltage power lines and so forth? Do you see this as an issue that we don't really have a way to have a natural control group as far as the electromagnetic environment is concerned anymore?
I understand your question. You're saying, is it not possible for us to answer the question whether anthropogenic electromagnetic energy is a health risk? We certainly can do that. And we can do that in controlled studies, certainly with animals, and to a certain extent with humans. I've conducted, I'd estimate anywhere between 20 and 25 human studies in which I applied electromagnetic energy and measured the effects. The effect that I measured was whether the brain changed its electrical activity. I'm measuring the EKG, and I compared the EKG in a given subject with the EKG when I expose him to the electromagnetic energy. So he sits there, and I give him an epic, call it 10 seconds. I apply the electromagnetic energy for 1 second. I pick another second in that, then I turn it off. And then I pick another second where he's not getting the energy. And I compare the electrical activity of the brain between the two sections. And I do this with maybe 100 epics. And I use statistical analysis to show, test my hypothesis that the brain detected. If it did, I can then the brain changed when the field was there. The subject doesn't know it's there. And I allow 8 more seconds before I go on to the next epic for the brain to return to normal. These are all experimental techniques that I can control in the laboratory that are ethical, that were approved by a human research committee that can answer the question of whether there's an effect or not on the brain. Now, I can't do the experiment and see if it's going to cause cancer. You're going to have to infer that from this kind of experimentation. The guys in industry would prefer that we not do those studies, that we don't go any further, don't learn that this energy is biologically active, and don't pursue the consequences of that. That's the great dynamic that's going on today in the world. But we can certainly answer the question of whether it's a health risk. We can't tell you exactly what cancer X is going to get. You're going to have to figure that out yourself and make a judgment whether you want to undergo the risk. We can tell you whether it's a risk or not. That's as far as we can go with existing ethical scientific standards. In Nazi Germany, you could have gone further. You can't do that further here.
Did you get any evidence to suggest that there may be inter-individual, so between people, variation in how people respond to certain electromagnetic energy?
You mean given one form of energy, people respond differently?
Yeah, different people respond differently to the same.
The experiment has not been done, and when you start thinking about the scientific criteria that would have to be done to answer the question scientifically, it'll never be done to the end of time. All that will be done will be experiments that indicate that electromagnetic energy has an effect on the body, and I'm going to give that effect a general name because it's the most effective and descriptive and correct designation that I know of. It's a stressor. It stresses the HPA axis just the way Hans Selye described. Now, an animal or human that's under stress is going to have his adaptive capacity to deal with factors in the world taxed. Besides dealing with electromagnetic energy, it's dealing with psychogenic stressors. It's dealing with somatic stressors, whether they ate right, whether they got enough exercise, a million other factors. All of these are stressors for the body, and the body's dealing with them, all of them. If you're in a too hot an environment, one explicit example is that the body starts sweating to release heat. If you're in a cold environment, the body starts shivering to generate heat. These are all autonomic processes that occur in relation to stresses. So there's a system in there that's running that for you. It can be taxed to the limit and it can break down. When it breaks down, we call that process disease. What disease? Well, any disease known to mankind. What determines whether you get X disease and he gets Y disease? It depends on whether you come from Australia and Sweden, whether you're black or white, whether you're a male or a female, what your genetic makeup is, and about a billion other issues. What you come down with when your system is overtaxed is unique to you. So, for example, if you want to know whether exposure to cell phones causes cancer, you don't look to see whether it causes cancer of histological type A or histological type B or only in the kidney or only in the prostate. Or you don't do that. You ask the question whether it causes cancer. And you do epidemiological studies where you sum over all cancers, not individual ones. If you break them into small slices, it's easy as hell statistically to hide reality. And that's, of course, what the industry epidemiologists do. You ask the question, is man-made electromagnetic energy associated with an increased risk for cancer as determined by epidemiologic data? Unquestionably, definitely, absolutely true. The answer is yes. Does it cause cancer type A, type B, type C? That very, very difficult to answer. It may be impossible to answer. You got to ask the right question.
It's very difficult to do, ask the right question, isn't it? And I think that is the issue when you're talking about something as general as stress. It's very easy to hide the reality when stress can cause any number of things. And I think that's really what's halting our ability to really understand. And, you know, you were talking about stress. This is something that's extremely interesting to me because it's quite difficult to find a really good holistic definition of what stress is. I'd love to get your thought on, you know, sort of how to define the term stress.
Hans Selye, it was really a great man. Had a pretty straightforward definition. At least that's what he expressed to me in our communications. He had his hands around the issue, and hence was violently opposed by the American biomedical establishment. At that time under the leadership of Philip Handler, who was president of the National Academy of Sciences in this pivotal period of time when all the rules that we have now got made. That's the dude responsible. And that's the book I'm writing about to explain to people how that guy did it. Once you get your hands around the concept of stress and regard it as nothing more than what he said it was, an activation of the HPA axis. It causes your body to react to something. I put you in a refrigerator, you do this. I put you in a desert, you do that. I deny food. The axis creates a different balance of hormones, and the hormones go to different receptors in different organs in the body. Including the nerves. There are three detection systems in the human body. There's the immune system, there's the nervous system, and there's the hormonal system. They each have their own chemical messengers. And they each of the organs, each of the parts of the three, have receptors for the other two systems. So it's a completely integrated, homogenized, cooperating, nonlinear system called the stress response system. Anything that activates it is a stressor. Not necessarily bad, but by definition, it activates the system. It becomes bad. The stressor becomes bad when it when it is something that takes the system over the top, and the system is no longer able to maintain what you might call homeostasis, and it breaks down, and bad things happen. A cancer could happen. The natural killer cell is a cell that goes around in the body looking for oncogenically transformed cells, and it kills them early in their lifetime. Hence, it doesn't grow to be a tumor and kill you. That's the body's immune detection system for fighting cancer. Well, if you overtax the body, the ability of the NK cells to do that goes down. It gets loaded. And as a result, some oncogenically transformed cells escape the net, and then they grow, and hence you get a clinical cancer. There's a relationship between how much of a demand you add to your body and how well your body can protect you. It's just so simple and so straightforward and so clear and so well understood that it's got to be obfuscated and hidden and lied about and distorted by people who have interests for doing so. But that's what Selye said it is. It's something that activates the axis.
I guess you could think of it as anything that really perturbs homeostasis is something that could be seen as a stress.
Well, that all depends on how you define homeostasis. Homeostasis is the whole process of keeping the body within certain limits. Now, you can move within limits, not at a point, within limits. And it's a whole complex array of things it's keeping within limits. So it refers to the whole general process of regulating the body. When you have an overload of one particular stressor, homeostasis may remain, but the ability to carry out the function to protect against the example I just gave you, cancer, is overtaxed. So you have homeostasis plus cancer because it no longer is protected.
That makes sense. That makes sense quite a bit. And I guess that really ties in this idea of hormesis. And I think this is something that Becker was dealing with as well, is that electromagnetic energy seems to be able to elicit good or bad responses. And we don't really have a way of identifying which direction that could move. Is this why he was sort of wary about Bassett making devices for bone growth? Because he wasn't sure whether that could... You're shaking your head.
Yeah. Listen, good or bad... By definition, is a subjective term. Mm-hmm. Dr. Becker really didn't use those terms in any meaningful way at all. The reason he broke with Bassett was because we had reached the point where we could show that electromagnetic energy could grow bone. And before it was going to be marketed, Dr. Becker wanted some experiments to show it would be safe. You just can't go put it in humans without... some what lawyers call pre-market approval. You know, you got to check first. Bassett didn't care about that. He started his own company, went right into the marketplace and got FDA approval, started selling them. And by 1982, he was the co-owner with three other people of the most profitable small business in the United States, a company called EBI. Who's making these devices for growing bone. Becker thought that was wrong. And we took a much slower approach. We were going to go into the laboratory and look for side effects. That was my job. So I designed experiments to see if the energy affected animals. The reasoning going to be, we can't do the experiment on people. That's not right. It's not legal. It's not ethical. It's not proper. I started finding adverse effects in animals, and that's when it hit the fan. That's when my life took a turn and took me for the next 45-50 years. Because the power companies and other industry organizations told me that I didn't know what I was doing and I shouldn't be doing those kinds of experiments. that's just no way to talk to me. I kept on going. I was able to keep on going because I had money. Where did I have money? Dr. Becker was raising it from the grants he was getting. And then after his laboratory was closed down because industry didn't like the results he was getting, I found a new job. And from 1981 to 2014, I had the terrific job, the best one that existed in the world. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. I was supported a little bit by government, mostly by my department chairman, who thought the work I was doing was important and who had the money because he was running a clinical department, which brought in money. And he gave me the money for equipment, to hire people, to buy animals and to conduct the search, and gave me complete freedom to design the experiments that I did. Jobs like that don't grow on trees. I might have had the only job like that that existed in the world or will ever exist in the world, because the world's changed a whole lot. But that's how I kept going, because I had the economic support of two people, Becker and the chairman of my department in the medical school in Louisiana, a guy named Jim Albright.
And speaking of bone, I mean, you worked a lot, well, Becker worked a lot with bone. That was one of his primary interests. And there's this idea of piezoelectricity, where sort of mechanical stress, I believe, on the bone produces this sort of current in the bone. And does this play any role in the regenerative process?
You're asking me a question that breaks my heart. Because right after I got my PhD, I spent 3 years studying piezoelectricity in bone. I wrote 10 or 15 papers. My hypothesis was that the mechanical piezoelectricity, it means the generation of electricity in a material by mechanical action. You apply a stress, and it generates an electrical signal. And it's a very complex property of matter. It exists in about 20 of the 32 crystal classes, minerals in nature. There's three kinds of stress. There are two kinds of stress. There's tensile, you pull or you push, that kind of stress. And then there's shear stress. So you got those two kinds of stresses, and both of those things have an axis. You can have this kind of stress along the x-axis, the y-axis, or the z-axis. And you can have shear along three axes. So the bottom line here is to relate force to the generation of electricity takes, in general, 32 constants to characterize the electricity that comes. Well, I couldn't categorize 32 in bone, because bone is not such a perfect crystal as the crystals of nature are. So I had to deal with a much simplified system, and I applied only compressive stresses, because it was vastly too complicated to do anything else. But I asked the question whether I could support the hypothesis that electricity was a signal to cells to grow bone, or a signal to cells to resorb bone. Because, you know, when you heal a fracture, you got to create cells that grow the bone. Then you got to make those cells go away. So you have to call other cells into being that eat the bone that's not needed, the dead bone or the extra bone that was generated. It's a complicated process. The idea that electricity could have a role in it was my theory, my hypothesis. I tried for 3 years. I made a lot of measurements, a lot of characterizations of piezoelectric effect. I could not answer the question you just asked. I just wasn't smart enough. I didn't have the resources, and I had more pressing problems to deal with, namely the health risks of electromagnetic energy from high voltage power lines. I took my experiments in that direction. So I left the whole thing exactly in 1973. I could go no farther with it, and no one has since.
That's so disappointing, because I've often wondered, you know, if you get a hairline fracture in your arm, for instance, they'll often immobilize it for many, many weeks to let it heal. And I've often wondered, if you're completely immobilizing it, then you're reducing the piezoelectric activity of the bones. And, you know, I wonder if that has any effect on the healing of the bone.
Well, it has a salutary effect in healing of the bone, because there's a crack between the bone, and really delicate tissues are forming in between, and they've got to be left alone. If the bone's going like this all the time, you're going to have a hell of a time forming anything. Nature took that into consideration. The piezoelectric effect, however, can still be implemented by muscle forces on the bone, which are natural and could have the signaling effect. So that's the thing that motivated me to go on. The forces don't have to come from pulling or walking, or they don't disappear when you stop pulling and stop walking. The muscles do it, and the muscles are forever moving. So the signal, by hypothesis and by expectation, given what we know about how muscles work, is there. So that didn't dissuade me from putting the third year into that three-year effort. I kept on going. But then I reached a point where I just had to quit and go on to something bigger, even though it broke my heart.
I can imagine, yeah, having to leave something that you've worked on for so long. Yeah. In Becker's books, he mentions working with acupuncture and his idea that acupuncture was having an effect on the bioelectric, this endogenous DC current in the body. How much did you ever, if at all, look at the impacts of acupuncture and this idea of meridians on the bioelectrics of the body?
Well, I spent 2 years working on it. In 1972, when President Nixon went to China and opened up China, one of the things that became important in the United States was understanding Chinese medicine. And at his assistance, and against their will, the National Institutes of Health offered 12 grants nationally to study acupuncture. By that time, Handler had control of the institutes, and it's the last thing in the world he would have permitted to be studied. But Nixon had more weight than Handler, so the 12 grants were awarded, and Becker got one of them. So now the money comes in, and we're going to study acupuncture. Well, it turned out in New York, where we were, that even though he was a physician, he could not perform acupuncture because he had to be a licensed acupuncturist, and he wasn't. And he was not about to go to school to learn to be one. I mean, he's running an orthopedic service at the hospital. So we sat down and decided that what we were going to do with experiments that put a scientific basis onto acupuncture, because it was mocked by organized medicine at the time. Not true today, but it certainly was mocked then. But Becker took a great interest in acupuncture because it represented the flow of energy. Now, from his point of view, that energy could have been electromagnetic energy. He didn't know, but he was open to it. One day, I'm going to divert a little bit from your question because I think its story is pertinent to your question. He held an orthopedic grand rounds and brought in an orthopedic surgeon, an acupuncturist, to demonstrate acupuncture to the orthopedic residents. So all the medical staffs there and the orthopedic residents were there, and they wheel in big guy, a really fat, obese guy. He's got severe degenerative arthritis in his knee. He can't bend his knee 3 degrees. He was wheeled into the theater where everybody was, and Dr. Becker motioned for the acupuncturist to do his job. So the acupuncturist walked over to the patient an emotion for a resident, senior resident, to come over and demonstrate what the problem was. The senior resident picks the guy's leg up and bends it 2 or 3 degrees, and the guy screams in agony, you know, just can't take it. So he puts it down and walks away. Acupuncturist goes over and he sticks a needle in here and a needle in there, one in the web of his finger, the hoku point, he called it, some in his, by his spine, some in his knee. Takes 15 minutes, goes around while he's doing, goes back to the original needles that are still in there and twists them a little. The whole thing takes about 15 to 20 minutes. Then he motions for the acupuncture, the resident to come back again. Resident comes back, picks up the leg and bends it almost to 90 degrees. I look at the patient. He's crying. I mean, he never saw it. I look at the orthopedic residents and they're just scratching their head. What they saw couldn't happen to this guy, but it happened in everybody's view. Everybody started clapping, but it was the most exciting moment that I'd ever had in my life up to that point. It was just amazing. That motivated Becker to apply for one of the grants. We got that. Now I'm back to your question. We got one of the grants. He couldn't do acupuncture. He had not enough money in the grant to bring the acupuncturist back and have him stay there and do the study. So I suggested doing experiments to put a scientific basis under the process of acupuncture. Now, acupuncture involves certain points, not all over the place, just along certain lines called meridians. And those points are here, here, and here, not in between. I mean, there's a 2,000-year-old model of where acupuncture points are. I mean, it didn't just happen last month. I said, well, if you look histologically at the point, you see nothing there. There's no nerve ending there. There's no structure. There's no magic cell at that particular point. Histologically, it looks like all the points above, below, to the right, and to the left of the acupuncture point. And you look at the meridian, the line, there's nothing magic about the line histologically. If you look, you take sections from a cadaver all the way up, you see nothing that indicates that there's a meridian there. Well, we used electrical methods, standard electrical methods, to determine whether a meridian existed. We send in a pulse of electricity at one point in the meridian and recorded it at another place in the meridian, and then analyzed the pulse and showed that it was different than if we put electricity in a non-meridian point, beginning and end, and a non-meridian line. So there's two lines on the arm. One is along the meridian, one is not along the meridian. We applied pulses at both points, and we show that the pulse is different only when it goes through the meridian, not along all non-meridian paths, indicating there's something physical about a meridian. It exists. That's the evidence that it exists. We did the same thing for acupuncture points. We measured electrical properties of acupuncture points versus electrical properties of acupuncture points, and showed that they differed. So, and we published all these papers. And to this day, there's still the most cited half a dozen papers in the scientific basis of acupuncture that exists today. We published 6 papers, and the gist of the papers was there's a physical basis for acupuncture. We didn't prove it was clinically successful. We did the most we could with the resources we had and the restrictions under which we functioned. And that's when Dr. Becker and I went on to other things. The grant expired, and Handler did everything he could to make sure those grants were never renewed. Nixon, by this time, is out of office. He's quit. NIH quickly quit doing acupuncture studies. We only had the grant for 2 years. Nixon's gone. Acupuncture research is gone. It didn't stop the establishment, despite what NIH thought, that there was some benefit to it, and it's gotten progressively more respect in the intervening years, despite the restrictions on research and the enmity toward it of the government's scientific establishment at NIH and NSF, where Handler was the head for 6 years.
And this is fundamentally working by changing the way that that this DC current is flowing in the body. So basically unblocking any blocks that might be there in the flow. Is that the idea?
No, the idea was to show that what the Chinese said was valid, present evidence for it. There is a thing called a meridian, and there's a thing called an acupuncture point. The evidence that needling them, scientific evidence that needling, that the Chinese are satisfied and have been for 2,000 years. In the Western world, the evidence that needling them produces clinical benefits is very, very, very slow and difficult to generate. How it works has not even been studied. You don't want to study how something works until you know it works. And if most people don't think it works, why the hell are they going to study how it works? It's crazy. It can't have a mechanism if it doesn't exist. You got to put the horse before the cart.
A lot of interesting work sort of along this vein is coming from Mike Levin's lab, and I know you know him or knew him many, many years ago. Has the work that's been coming out of his lab been surprising to you, or do you see this just as sort of a logical continuation of what you and Becker were doing, many decades ago?
I see it as neither. Mike Levin is, in my mind, a decent man. I'd like him. He was cursed from the beginning because his mentor Lionel Jaffe was a truly evil man who was largely responsible at Handler's bidding, closing Dr. Becker's laboratory. And I think Levine sensed weaknesses in his mentor. So he had a tough time getting started in his personal career after he escaped from that that Purdue environment. He sent me a letter, and I still have it, in the early 80s, asking me advice about certain things, and I provided it. I thought his questions were interesting, and I certainly wanted him to succeed, although I had my doubts he would, because where's he going to get his money? Who's going to allow him to pursue what Becker did? And now what he did do over this whole career, as far as I can tell, was nothing more than Becker did. Becker worked on planaria, got started that way. Becker worked on regeneration. I see nothing that Mike did that advanced what Becker did. I got to admit, I fell off following him carefully years ago. So my opinion may be somewhat dated. But as far as I've taken it, I've seen him take it nowhere past the level that Dr. Becker left it. And if you see something that did, you need to let me know.
Okay, I'll definitely keep that in mind. Mike seems to be delving into a lot of philosophy and, sort of cybernetics. And he's...
Oh, wait a minute, right there. Two very different words now. Philosophy, I got my own philosophy, but we're not going to talk about that. Cybernetics is the heart and soul of what Becker was doing. Mm. So those two things are monstrously different. I hate to see them in the same sentence.
I apologize for that. one thing that I got really interested in going back through all of your published literature is this idea that cancer cells are more often than not depolarized when compared to their healthy counterparts. They've sort of lost their membrane potential, I guess you could say. Do you think this is sort of a cause or an effect of that type of malignant growth?
Listen, you misinterpreted my work, and in the answer to your question, it's neither.
Okay.
I just show that an experimental model of a cancer cell was demonstrated depolarization relative to a non-cancer cell. So I suggested from that that might be part of the mechanistic chain that leads to the development of cancer. It has nothing to do with what causes cancer. What causes cancer, the really salient question, the thing that's most important to everybody on Earth, because if they know what it is, they'll avoid it, is a global question, because cancer causing is an emergent property. It doesn't have a molecular explanation. And the latter part of your question, good or bad, that's just a subjective characterization of an observation. It doesn't go beyond that. It has no generalizing significance.
You've touched on something really important there, and it always bothered me when learning biochemistry, you know, that they basically teach it as if all of the biochemical actions are sort of just guided by themselves, and there's no sort of organizing principle. This chemical goes to that one goes to that one, and you don't need to explain how that happens and how everything's so orchestrated and well and so coherent together in the body. What are your insights into how biochemistry is sort of governed, how it finds its blueprint?
It doesn't have a blueprint. The process you just described was exactly the core of the book that I'm writing now. Handler maintained that, and he was the premier biochemist in America in the whole 20th century. He maintained that every biological phenomenon has a biochemical explanation. He was dead wrong. All important biological phenomena are emergent phenomena. They come at the higher level. Consciousness, fracture healing, the development of the embryo, cancer, osteoarthritis. These are all emergent phenomena that don't have molecular explanation. They result from interactions at many levels, very complicated interactions, all mediated by electromagnetic energy. How do we know that? Because only electromagnetic energy can act at a distance. It can homogenize the performance of a piece of nature. Biochemistry takes place at one particular point. It doesn't need electromagnetic energy. That's why the biochemists have no use for electromagnetic energy. In the beginning, when biochemistry got started, there wasn't a biochemistry department in the United States that taught the laws of physics, the Maxwell's equations, to biochemists. Today, in 2025, there still isn't a biochemistry department in the United States that teaches PhD candidates Maxwell's equations. They have no use for electromagnetic energy. That's why biochemistry is a simplistic, absolutely useful and necessary, because underneath it all, it's not the finger of God, as Dr. Becker would say, that makes things go. Underneath it all, there's chemical reactions. But there's got to be, the question you pose, some organization. That's what he wanted to study, and that's what organized science funding in the United States has prohibited ever since the end of World War II. So biochemists are the least people in the world you want to ask those questions. Unfortunately, they control all spending for research at NIH. It's the only reason I can see that the guy who's going to influence today NIH, this guy Kennedy, as wacko as he is, and he's wacko, the only good thing that's going to come out is what he does to NIH. It needs a good kick in the slats. It needs to allow emergent phenomena to be studied. It has banned the study of emergent phenomena since the end of World War II, since it was created in the 50s.
You've said, "I'm not hopeful until the science Philip Handler left us goes away." What does this look like? You know, you're talking about revamping. What do you think needs to be included and excluded in order to help young people, young scientists, really grasp this idea of emergent phenomenon and move away from a biochemistry first model?
You did it again. You put a perfect phrase at the end, a perfect answer to the question you just asked. The ability to study emergent phenomena is the thing that's got to be done. Now, if they're going to go to graduate school and want to do something in the area of biomedical research, if they're going to go in and just study biochemistry, they're wasting their time. And they're not going to have a job. Nobody's going to pay attention to their work, unless, of course, it happens to be commercially profitable. So if they want to be slaves to industry, go do that. The only way we're going to change things is if we allow emergent phenomena to be studied. That's all Becker wanted. He wanted emergent phenomena to be studied. He used to say that when I would propose, when people would object to what he said, let's do some biochemical studies to support this or to support that. And he'd say, "Marino, that's stamp collecting. Let other people do that. Let's stay at a higher level where it's more important." And it stuck with me my whole life. That's truth. That's what I would advise young people. Now, they're limited about what they can do. They're going to have to be awful careful. Going into science today is a terribly, terribly risky process. Why? How are you going to support a family? Who's going to hire you? The great, great majority of jobs are with industry or government, at least before this last month anyway, with government. People working for government, mostly you've got to do what the government agency wants. People working for industry got to do what their industry wants. People who are hired by universities are expected, when they do research, to work for the government. To get NIH grants or NSF grants. If they don't, they were not going to get a tenure job. So why would you go into science today? Think about that. And think about it real hard and make a plan around these obvious obstacles to living a happy life, being able to support a family. Like, my son came home one day in college and said he wanted to graduate school and study philosophy. I said, "Chris, sit down." And we had a talk. And we settled on studying psychology. And that's what he got his PhD in. And he made his living doing various kinds of work that stemmed in that direction. He could support a family. He could support himself. You know, he's going to leave home. He's got to take care of himself. I'm not going to be here forever. You got to think about that.
Are there studies in the area of research that you were involved in, or the areas, I should say, that you would want to see done that never got done?
What I would like to see, would generalize to younger people in today's world. The very last experiment I did before I retired in 2014 was to show that cell phone electromagnetic energy affects the electrical activity of the human brain. Now, so far, I'm the only, this is now 10 years old, 11 years old, there have been no follow-up studies to determine whether the human brain activity is affected by the presence of a cell phone sitting right here. I would like to see that confirmed because I think it would provide a motivation for people to demand that the government go further into the question of whether cell phones are safe. Right now, they're held to be safe based on the biochemical mumbo jumbo, absolute crap, by a man named Hermann Schwann, who worked in a Nazi laboratory during World War II and was brought to the United States by the military because he had taken positions and created arguments that would defend the exposure levels to microwaves that the military felt it needed if it was going to protect the country. They have the responsibility for defending the security of America, so they have special rules that apply to them in terms of exposures of servicemen. The special rules and Supreme Court doctrines, like the Furries Doctrine, that give them the right to do that, because they're dealing on in the area of protecting the existence of the country. Industry protects the existence of the country at a much lower level. The economy is necessary, but not like the military. Well, Schwann justified their exposure levels, which are huge, and now industry is using Schwann's work to justify the exposure levels to cell phones. Now, cell phones are really important. No one's going to take them away. They're here forever. But experiments should be done that allows the American people to understand that there's a health risk if they use them. Go ahead and use them. There's a health risk using cigarettes. There's no law against cigarettes. There's not going to be any law against cell phones. That's not the way America works. But you got to tell the people in its stark significance what the risks are that we can tell from ethical experimentation and let them make up their mind. Evidence to support that approach is needed. Where the money's going to come from for that approach, I don't know. I don't see any sources now. The philanthropies that existed before the government took over funding research in the 50s and drove the philanthropies away, essentially, those philanthropies aren't there anymore. A Handler got started doing experiments from philanthropies. That's where he got his original money. That's where biochemistry got its start. Now it all comes from industry, and industry gets biochemical studies done that it wants done. And conversely, it blocks stuff that it doesn't want done. Money drives research. Research is an expensive proposition. Every year that goes by, it's more expensive. If you don't provide for money, honest scientists will never do the experiments that the public needs. It's just that simple.
It's a harsh reality, I think, and it's difficult to come to grasp to it, to come to grasp with it, especially if you have this sort of idealistic idea of, you know, the government's looking out for me. They wouldn't have anything, you know, if it's not safe, they certainly wouldn't allow access to it.
Right. And remember the three personalities of science.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about mobile phones. This is a personal device. How do you feel about things like cell towers or high voltage power lines that are exposing people, you know, perhaps without their, you know, without their consent? You know, these things are being built around their area. They're being exposed to them, you know, even if they don't want to be. How do we navigate this in the modern world?
Let's break it into two pieces, high voltage power lines and cell phones. The concern that that people along high voltage power lines who are being exposed against their will, I advanced when I testified in New York and was cross-examined, I might say, for 13 days by the guys who represented the power companies. that it was a form of involuntary human experimentation. And I still think that's the case. Over the years, the issue has, for details I can't go into now, has been essentially wiped away following a 1990s NIH study of the effects of power lines. The NIH approved the safety of power lines as they were then. In other words, no protection. I won't go into the story about that. I've already described that in my books and in my articles on my website. People think that the energy along power lines goes through the wire. It doesn't. It goes outside the wire. How far outside? That's the 750,000-volt power lines in New York. It extends almost a mile on either side of that right away. People live in that energy flow, and it's there 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, and they live in that flow. And that flow didn't exist from the beginning of time until they started building power lines. Now they live in it. And they just assume it has no consequences. When you get within, let's say, 500 meters on either side of the power line, the strength of that energy flow, to me, is scary. Well above whatever existed in nature. They live in it day in and day out forever. They raise their kids in it. But that's the reality of it. It's a risk. They don't appreciate the risk. Being able to appreciate the risk was denied to them following the NIH handling of the issue. I started it. Becker started it, I should say, in 1973. He was driven out of his job in 1980. In 1990, by 1995 and 1996, NIH had vitiated the improvements Becker and I had brought by testifying in a New York power line hearing. So we were right back to where we started. They wiped away what we had accomplished. So now there's no protection to anybody, anywhere. What are the consequences? Who knows?
Given that you have shown so elegantly that we do respond to electromagnetic fields and an electromagnetic energy, what did we evolve? You know, we evolved in the native, the natural electromagnetic energy. What did the natural background electromagnetic energy provide to our bodies, do you think?
Well, I don't know exactly. It's changed over in the 14 billion years, 20 billion years since the universe somehow got formed, 10 billion years, the solar system's been in effect, and the 1 million years life has evolved on Earth, starting there, the electromagnetic background, the natural electromagnetic background, hasn't changed in any material way. There's the cosmic sources. They haven't changed. And there's the magnetic field from the Earth. That's it. All evolution took place, governed by the presence of that energy. In other words, the emergence of life compensated for that, or took advantage of it, or protected it against it, or used it, but accommodated to it in a certain way. And that's the way it went for 2 billion years. Then Marconi and Edison come along and invent the antennas, Tesla, and power lines, and things changed a lot from, say, 1850 to 1950. And then after 1950, I mean, it was Katie barred the door. We had power lines crisscrossing the country. The voltages were up to 750,000 volts. And if the industry has its way, it's going to go to a million. I think it has gone to a million in some places. We started building antennas, radiating enormous amounts of energy. In the beginning, when the EPA just got started, it would go into big cities. You can look on the EPA website and you can see the measurement of the man-made electromagnetic energy in the microwave region in 12 cities, downtown cities, major buildings, et cetera. And you can see the levels are 100,000 times or a million times the level before they built them. And then for political purposes, the EPA stopped making measurements. So nobody now makes measurements in the city the way they did. They stopped making them before sometime in the early 1980s, mid-1980s. Now, nobody knows what's going on in the cities. In some foreign cities, they made measurements. But the idea has been to not inform the public of how much the living space has changed so dramatically, so quickly, and with no forethought regarding its consequences. No, what I call free market approval. But that's the world we live in, and that's what we accept.
I think a lot of people are starting to get interested in how to minimize the risks, because like you said, we really don't understand all of this and what the consequences might be. What we know is that it's stressful to the body, and people will probably want to know what you think about how to minimize one's risk, particularly people who have young families and, you know, they want to set up in a place where they're going to minimize the risk as much as possible. So what can people do?
Well, number one, they can be realistic. They live in a world where they're subjected to numerous stresses. Stresses are cumulative. Sellier taught us that. If you're going to break down and develop disease, it's going to be because your homeostatic system has been perturbed to the point where certain defenses no longer exist. So the most rational thing to do is to minimize your stressors. If you're going to stick a phone beside your ear, compensate for it by avoiding other identifiable stressor. Be reasonable. If you're going to pour water in here, pour water out there. To take that into consideration. If you're serious about devoting some of your time and energy to dealing with the problem, talk to your representatives about what's being done to make sure that the consequences of modern technology are safe. You can have reasonable confidence in the drugs that you take because the FDA requires pre-market approval. You can have reasonable confidence in the food additives, although it's a real crapshoot. The FDA regulates them to a certain extent, fighting like hell with industry, who always wants to have higher levels. And also from time to time, putting their representative in the federal agency that makes the decisions, which cuts out the floor from underneath you. But being aware that there are very, very few people looking out for your health because they value the economy of the country, it's what they call it, but the availability of jobs is more important than your particular health. If you accept that, do nothing. If you don't accept that, figure out something efficient and effective that you can do. Just don't close your eyes and walk away, which of course is what most people do.
Well, I'm very conscious of your time and I don't want to take too much more of it. But I just want to say, you know, the people who say never meet your heroes, they must be wrong, because this has been such an incredible conversation. And just to hear you speaking, It's such a big deal for me, so thank you so much for giving me some of your time.
Great to talk to you.
Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I really hope you enjoyed it. I've left links to Andrew's website below. There you'll be able to find all of his scientific publications, books, and even more. I strongly encourage everyone to read his books in chronological order, as they are an invaluable resource. I've also left all of my links in the episode notes, so please feel free to subscribe and engage, as there will be much more content like this to come. If you'd like to support my work, please consider subscribing to my Substack. This is where I share most of my thoughts and insights that go beyond this podcast. The support really helps me keep this going, so thanks again for listening, everyone. Take care.